Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two perspectives on the COVID era today. We'll hear from Thomas Segrew and Caitlin Zaloom, editors of a 2020 Reader, and then Laura Kipnis, author of Love in a Time of Contagion, will muse on the delights of living together, a challenge even in the best of times. The coronavirus may be a single pathogen, the one that mutates in annoying ways, but its effects have varied enormously by place and status. My first two guests, Thomas Segrew and Caitlin Zaloom, are just out with a book they edited, The Long Year, a 2020 Reader. Of course, 2021 robbed 2020 of some of its uniqueness, and 22 isn't off the hook yet either, but the year will probably be remembered as a terrible one for a long time to come. The book is a collection of about 50 essays that examine the dimensions of the crisis, by country, by occupation, by age, class, gender, and race, and much more. The pandemic exposed a host of social fissures that have always been there, but came out into even starker view as disease and death spread very unequally. Thomas Segrew, who's been on this show several times before, is a professor of history at NYU. He's written on cities, notably Detroit, race, and housing and real estate. Caitlin Zaloom is a cultural anthropologist who also teaches at NYU. She's a co-founder of Public Books, a website that tries to bridge the gap between academics and the broader reading public, and is one of the editors of its book series, published by Columbia University Press. This book, The Long Year, is part of that series. Here are Thomas Segrew and Caitlin Zaloom. So I know you put this book out about as quickly as you could put a book out, but still, books take time. So in the interval, since things were finished and the book has appeared, anything you would change at this point significantly, or has things pretty much as you left them when you finished editing the book?
I think most of the book is very timely still. We are in not just the long year, as our book title suggests, but a long few years. But inevitably, a set of reflections from the moment leaves subsequent developments out. And the biggest one that we don't address in the book is the anti-vax movement or anti-vax impulse that's swept through the United States, especially, but much of the world. I don't think any of us anticipated that this would go from a small circle of cranks to a really large movement endorsed by one of the major political parties in the United States.
Yes, no, since crossed the border to Canada, which is supposed to be the nice country.
Right. I mean, it is. Like so much of 2020, things spread virally, and the anti-vax movement has spread virally, maybe halted only in the places where there's still a lot of faith in science and trust in government and governmental institutions. But in places where there's suspicion, the anti-vax movement has really become a pandemic itself.
Yeah, Kate, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, I think what I would say is that actually, even though we don't address the issue of the anti-vax movement, it could definitely benefit from the same kind of treatment that we gave the other subjects in the long year, which is to say that we had some precursors to it that I think both sociologists and historians have been looking at over decades now, particularly in the resistance that parents have put up against vaccinating their kids against things like measles, and even something what this might seem totally innocuous, like the flu vaccine. We've seen outbreaks of measles in states like California and in Southern California. And so I think that if we had gone back and included the anti-vax movement, there would have also been a lot of knowledge there to draw on that we didn't have a chance to really think through.
Yeah, this anticipates a question I was going to ask a little later, but the IMF did a study kind of early in the pandemic. I don't know, maybe late spring, early summer of 2020, and they discovered that one of the features of a pandemic, and they look back going decades, maybe centuries, that political unrest is often a part of or result of or a sequel to a pandemic. So it's amazing that, a lot of your book is talking about demonstrations and political unrest, not just in the U.S., but around the world. But then we never could have anticipated it was going to take this right-wing form. It wasn't just coming from the left, broadly defined.
Absolutely. I think many of our essayists grapple with the particular politics of 2020 and the rise of right-wing insurgencies. And I think some of the strongest essays in the book embed that emergence of a political right, which is essential to understanding the Anti-Vax movement too, of course, embed that in the failure of the state, the failure of governmental institutions in a wide variety of different countries. We have essays on the failure of the Indian state to deal with the problem of informal employment, of the kind of the vast unregulated labor market, or the problem of Brazil not adequately grappling, even under its leftist regime, with the really deep inequalities that continue to mean radically different life experiences for people living within a few miles of each other. And of course, the history of the United States, of our inadequate responses to the economic crises of 2008, and the fact that in a bipartisan way, inequality has risen in the United States steadily since the 1970s. And so those are all the soil that the discontent of 2020 has grown and proliferated in.
I would add to that too, that there are several authors in the book, including the author Yarmar Bonilla, who writes about Puerto Rico, where we can take the experiences of places outside the United States, or in the case of Puerto Rico, in colonial relation to the United States, as being a way to understand what happened here in the United States in a better way. And specifically what I mean by that is when Bonilla writes that Puerto Ricans largely kind of anticipated the layered crises that they have long experienced when it came to COVID. You know, COVID for them came on top of an earthquake that happened in 2020. And it happened on top of Hurricane Maria. So if we took those experiences more seriously and put them kind of at the center of our thinking about a crisis like COVID, we might more easily see all of the ways that the crises kind of pile up and then explode under the conditions of an emergency.
Yeah, the whole pandemic has seemed to accentuate fissures, pre-existing fissures, whether of class, race, ethnicity, geography, gender, occupation. You know, it just split so many things wide open and made them very, very apparent. They were always there before, but it just really brought them out into screaming relief.
I think that is especially clear in the ways in which the pandemic disproportionately affected here in the United States, people of color, working class folks working in the so-called essential industries, who are invariably the lowest paid, who work long and irregular hours, and who are the victims of decades of neglect, of workplace safety regulation, of the collapse of support for organized labor, and so on. And so we're you know, very much seeing, and where the pandemic has hit most devastatingly, we're seeing the long-term effects of the pre-existing conditions of the neglect of working people in American society.
Your book is international in scope. It covers lots and lots of topics, but lots and lots of geographies. Now, are there commonalities around the world, or is it a collection of local stories, this pandemic?
There are a lot of commonalities, I think. I mean, obviously, different countries have responded differently to the pandemic, have different pre-existing histories of, say, police brutality and state violence. But I think one common thread that runs through many of the studies or many of the chapters in this book are the ways in which, I guess we could say, in an era of global neoliberalism, that the notion of there being a collective project, in this case, a collective project of taking mutual responsibility for our health, right? The kind of the fundamental of public health is what affects me also affects you, and what affects you also affects me. That's been in much of the world thrown to the wind. That said, I will say that some of the essays in our volume offer counter narratives. That is, there's an account of a grassroots health movement in one of the largest favelas in Latin America, in Sao Paulo, by one essayist who looks at how community members organized to provide health services where the state was failing and not stepping in under Bolsonaro. And the movement here in New York and in other cities of folks banding together to provide food and assistance to homebound people during the COVID pandemic, especially immunocompromised people, is another example of the ways in which we do have some uplifting models of solidarity that have emerged during the pandemic, even as we're swimming against a really powerful tide of a lack of an understanding of collective responsibility.
Yeah, I would add to that a commonality around gender. I think we saw in many, many different instances, you know, some of which we cover in the long year, that women provide a fundamental safety net, especially under conditions where the state has failed. It's amazing to me that somehow in the US, we hadn't quite grappled with the fact that women provided that safety net, and it was made very much in, you know, all of our faces during the pandemic, especially when schools closed and children were sent home and women were suddenly foisted many more responsibilities than they already shouldered. But that was not unusual. And one of the really fundamental commonalities is that women across the globe shoulder the responsibility both for family and for livelihood, which the virus made very, very clear.
The contrast, I mean, you have chapters on China and India, the approaches to the pandemic in those two countries, the two largest in the world, has been rather different.
Definitely. The Indian story is one of an attempt to basically try to shut down the economy, to do a massive lockdown during the peak of the pandemic, which proved impossible in a country of a billion people, most of whom did not have the ability to stay home. And home was crowded, right, when they did stay home. But the vast majority of people had to continue to work. Folks can't don't have the luxury of locking down, you might say, or the ability to work at home like professionals like ourselves were able to do during the pandemic. That combined with the fact that there's not much of a social support system there to respond to the needs of the most precarious in the population proved to be really devastating. I mean, India had a very high infection rate and a relatively high mortality rate, not as high as other parts of the world because the population is relatively young, but still, given the youth of the population, it was a devastating, had devastating effects that the state simply couldn't solve.
Yeah, I think that also brings us back to another really fundamental commonality, which is that the pandemic exposed how much informational control really is central to governance across different countries. And different countries obviously dealt with that in very, very distinct ways, with China trying to kind of completely lock down information, India not collecting it, and then having COVID explode. And then, of course, here in the United States, having a very strange combination of both denialism on the one hand, and then from the media, a kind of overload of detail that was in the end, not always necessarily very illuminating. And that's in part like where we feel like this book steps in, because there is a lot of information that we knew academics had, especially in understanding the roots of the crisis, that we could bring out. So we're trying to kind of take our own approach to this problem of information.
That's the voice of Caitlin Zaloom, co-editor along with Thomas Segru, whom we're also hearing from, of The Long Year, a 2020 reader just out from Columbia University Press. The pandemic could have been a moment for people to consider more the social origins of disease, whether we're talking about the Wall Street Journal early in the pandemic months. Did a survey of New York City neighborhoods and found that the best predictor of disease spread was residential density, that is, the number of people living per room, not per square mile, but per room. And, you know, we haven't really learned any of those lessons. We've not really learned much in the way of lessons about social solidarity, it seems. Some of us have, but many of us haven't. Any possible lesson about climate change and future pandemics seems to have largely escaped us. It's like humanity faced several tests here and we've failed most of them. Is that too despairing an evaluation?
I would say that the United States has failed many of them. I'm not sure that across the board, but there's been plenty of failure. I mean, one thing that I would really emphasize, especially when it comes to learning the lessons of the pandemic for the social origins of disease, is that we need trust in institutions that communicate with us about what is happening around the disease. And we did not have that with the CDC as it is currently configured, and certainly as it existed under the Trump administration when the disease broke out. The fact that there is such skepticism is even too light a word, but a fundamental distrust in government means that we don't take the assessment of the viral threat seriously. And that's not always the case. I mean, you know, say in Korea, that wasn't the case. In Denmark, that wasn't the case. Even in Australia, where there was a white right-wing government, that wasn't the case. So, you know, I think that we have to really consider what it means that we don't have the kind of trust in government, which is also a trust in our collectivity here in the United States.
Not much good has emerged around global governance either. I mean, it's not been a model of international cooperation, it seems. Again, with the climate crisis facing it, where we need more of that, we don't seem to have made much progress in that area.
Right. I mean, think about the emergence of new variants of the virus, Omicron, coming from a population that has long been underserved in terms of health measures, that is South Africa. But in addition, large parts of the world are still woefully under-vaccinated. And that's an area where international collaboration and cooperation largely failed us. The unvaccinated parts of the world are going to be the incubators of the next strains of the virus for sure, not to mention long-term economic instability, political insecurity, and higher rates of illness and mortality that will have an impact on every part of the life in those places, but rebounding back to us because ultimately we didn't collectively use our resources to vaccinate widely.
And we could have, and we failed that one.
Absolutely.
Cities, I know a subject that's dear to you, Tom. The early phases of the pandemic, people said, oh yeah, it's just a New York City disease, you know, and a lot of people in the rest of the country. There was an op-ed in the New York Times by Amy Wilentz, I believe, who said, oh, in LA, we're getting off lightly because of our car-centered sprawl lifestyle, which turned out, of course, not to be the case. But what impact long-term is this pandemic going to have on something I cherish very much, urban life? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, we historians, at least I'm a historian, we when we look into crystal balls, we see a lot of clouds and opacity. It's really hard to predict the future. That said, cities historically have been very resilient in the wake of pandemic, natural disaster, and war. And all signs point to the continued energy and vitality of cities. That doesn't mean they're going to change. I mean, they're going to change pretty profoundly. I mean, we're seeing that in the mass vacancies in commercial real estate in downtowns all over the United States and in many parts of the world because folks are working remotely. What impact that's going to have over time on urban real estate markets, on speculation, on the real estate and finance sectors is a really much, very much an open question. When it comes to the kind of intense sociability that cities offer their populations, people are scrambling to get back, sometimes to the negative consequences of their health. I mean, packing into bars and Paris and in corner pubs and in London, because ultimately cities allow for that kind of sociability. And I think as humans, cities are going to have that unique function indefinitely into the future. That's one place where my crystal ball is clear.
Yeah, I would also add to that cities are places where it's really hard to escape your interconnection with other people. So, you know, here in New York City, we got hit very, very hard very, very early in this pandemic. And we're also a city that has continued wearing masks and following protocols in order to keep each other safe. You know, and with all due respect to LA and their car culture, I think that it's the denser cities where more hope lies for making progress on, say, deepening our epidemiological understandings of things like the social roots of sickness.
Eric Kleinenberg has a chapter in the book about rebuilding social solidarity, which is something that it seems to me we need very, very badly. Any thoughts from either of you on that task?
We put the essay as the closing one in the collection precisely because he offers what we think is a very compelling direction forward, which is to build a new or rejuvenate existing institutions that foster and strengthen our ties, our solidarity. Ultimately, the lessons that he draws for contemporary public policy are we need to think more about our neighbors, our neighborhoods, our places, our ties to each other, and foster the kinds of social networks and especially robust institutions to help each other. And I think there's no better sign-off to a book that often is full of grim accounts of what was happening during 2020 to move forward.
Kate, do you have any thoughts on that?
Focusing in on that institutional level is really, really essential because one of the critical pieces that has very much broken down, here in the United States and also in lots of places around the world over the last 40 years has been that trust in institutions. And so it's important both at the neighborhood level in places like libraries and schools, and it's important at the national level, like I was mentioning before, the Center for Disease Control, and it's important also at the international level. I mean, one I think very hopeful piece of evidence is that there are remaining very strong ties among scientists. One of the key ways that information moved around the world about the academic was scientist to scientist. And the issue isn't like, are those people there? They are there and they're doing the right thing. We have to find a way to kind of institutionalize and to spread their kind of understanding in a way that doesn't immediately trip the opposition of governments like of the United States and China and Brazil among them.
Yeah, but you know, after almost 2 years now of people hunkering down, being afraid of their fellow human, quivering indoors, afraid that your neighbor's going to make you sick, a lot of social ties have been broken and people have been habituated to a kind of isolation. People are not working together in the ways that they used to. Although, you know, according to the BLS, we're only like 11% of us or 12% of us have been working at home. Have a feeling sometimes that it's been much higher. But still, there's a sense of isolation that disease avoidance has fertilized. Is there any way to undo that damage? Or is it the desire for contact, social and physical, is going to triumph over that that experience?
I think that desire for contact is a really powerful elemental one, but also sometimes for better, maybe in this case, sometimes for worse, people have a short attention span and a short memory. If we look back at the influenza pandemic of 1918 to 1921, a series of very long years, it quickly got forgotten to the point of where it barely shows up in history textbooks and in curricula. It will now, but it didn't for quite a long time because folks plunged right back into the social in the 1920s from the proliferation of speakeasies and entertainment venues to the rise or resurgence of grassroots organizations like trade unions and fledgling civil rights groups. It was a period of a lot of energy and creativity. And so I hold out optimism that we will move away from our isolation back into some period of connectivity again.
Kate, do you share those good feelings?
I do. You know, I think that we have, and we even have a piece of evidence about it, which is that the racial justice protests, in addition, of course, being fueled by the by murder and oppression, were also fueled by a desire to be together and to make change together. And that was shared by people around the world. And I think that that is a really important fuel for the protest that was very much on display there, but which can also, I think, be translated into these more local, less emergency-driven contexts that we need for people to gather and make change.
Yeah, somewhere between 15 and 26 million people took to the streets of the United States in the aftermath of the murder of George Floyd. It dwarfs in numbers and in locales any period of grassroots protest in all of American history. The civil rights struggle, the anti-war movement in the 1960s, the marches during the Great Depression and for the unemployed and those demanding a reform of the financial system. I mean, they were important, but it got totally overwhelmed by the numbers in 2020. But not only that, but 2020 quickly became global. And a bunch of the essays in our collection look at the ways in which the Black Lives Matter protests took different form in places as diverse as Brazil, France, Mexico City, Great Britain, often learning from what was happening in the United States, being inspired by the huge protests in the street, but also taking distinctive form, responding to the distinctive needs of marginalized populations in those countries. So just as the virus kind of went global, so too have some forms of solidarity and resistance broken out of their local confines and spread worldwide. And that, to me, is one of the heartening stories of the long year.
Those are Thomas Segrue and Caitlin Zaloom, editors of The Long Year, a 2020 reader just out in the public book series from Columbia University Press. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after musical break.
But it's a loaded gun to me. Well, I'm sick of keeping quiet, and I am the wild boy. I'm sick of keeping quiet, and I am the wild boy. Well, if I have to die here first, I'm gonna make some noise.
That was some of Kill City by Iggy Pop and James Williamson from 1977. And now a more intimate view of life in the COVID era. Laura Kipnis is just out with Love in the Time of Contagion, published by Pantheon. Kipnis, a professor emeritus at Northwestern, is a cultural theorist and critic and a former video artist who has written provocatively, in the best sense, as she put it in her Northwestern bio, on the intersections of American politics, psyche, and the body, with detours through love, Marx, gender distress, adultery, scandal, Freud, and the legacy of the avant-garde. Love in the Time of Contagion consists of four essays on the intertwined topics of eros, cohabitation, and ambivalence against the backdrop of disease and social isolation. It's a smart and funny look at some not very pleasant topics. Laura Kipnis. Just before I hit the record button, I said how much I enjoyed your book and that you're a very funny writer, and you worried that being funny undermines your being taken seriously. Why do you think that is?
Men are allowed to be funny more than women are, and I don't usually play the gender card so early in an interview, but in fact, I was just reading a piece in The Guardian today about a woman who was complaining about not being taken as seriously, a British writer, as male writers were, so it was on my mind. But yeah, I think that, I mean, I guess somebody like Philip Roth got away with it. And I think Saul Bellow is incredibly funny, and he's somebody who I've been very influenced by. But yeah, I think the humorist label possibly makes you seem more superficial or trivial. I don't know. Is that true?
I guess, yeah. Did Hegel make any jokes? I don't know. But you know, you mentioned a couple of guys in disrepute there, Roth and Bellow.
Is Bello? Oh, I guess they are in disrepute. Bello also.
Well, I guess because his politics are pretty right wing, and
that's true.
Roth is a bad boy.
Yeah, you know, back in the days when being a quote bad boy was also part of the license that accrued to novelists, and we're living in different times.
Yes, we certainly are. Early in the book, you mentioned Sartre's No Exit, which is something I haven't read in decades. But I don't know, did you reread it recently? It does seem like it almost acquired a fresh relevance for our time.
Well, I was reading all this literature of domestic claustrophobia and looking for the more offbeat candidates. So I suppose No Exit, where you've got three people stuck in hell and they're all people guaranteed to deprive the other two people of what they most need in the world. I thought that was a good analog for pandemic times. But the other thing that was so great that I was reading, if we're talking about French lit, was Ionesco's play Amadé. Forget the subtitle, but it's about a couple in Paris who are cohabiting with a corpse who keeps getting larger and larger. It's a, this is theater of the absurd, so it's an absurd premise, but it also seemed very close to the situation, the domestic situation I was in pandemic times, which was a neighbor down the hall having COVID and just never knowing day to day if he was dead or alive. You know, this was in the early days when you just had no idea what was happening. But I was, you know, reading, as I said, the literature of domestic claustrophobia and also domestic partners wanting to kill each other. That was good pandemic reading.
Yes. But you also have an example of a couple who are living in a suburban house overflowing with trash and worse. So between that and the swelling corpse, this is not an inspiring vision of domestic life you're offering.
The people with the garbage hoarders, which is another subject that's fascinating. I actually read that as maybe in my late teens. It happened, I grew up in Chicago and it happened in a suburb of Chicago where this couple were, you know, this normal middle-class couple were discovered to be living in a house overflowing. I mean, like 6 foot high with garbage and shit and stuff that went back 10 years and nobody knew about it. And I don't know, that just has stuck with me all of these years later. And it's something I suppose about what happens behind closed doors, what we don't know about other people's lives. And somehow these scenes of domestic horror, despite my having been in this long-term relationship, somehow those scenes resonate with me.
Yes. Well, when I was, my first marriage was breaking up and I was taking up with my current wife and I hope who will be my wife for the rest of my life. My mother was urging me to stick with my first wife because she pointed out her mother and father didn't talk to each other for years, but at least they stayed together. The ideal of a certain kind of married life was a silent tolerance of each other, but not much more than that.
Of course, there used to be so much more stigma attached to, you know, a marriage ending. So I suppose your mother was worried about the whole family being stigmatized.
Now, it seems that you've got several themes in the book. You've got the living together in the COVID lockdown with your cellmate. You've got a Me Too chapter, a chapter about codependency. But the unifying theme seems to be that we really, really have a hard time living with each other. That there's just a fundamental deep ambivalence about humans, that love and hate are constant inseparable companions. Is that the view that you're expressing?
And also I was just interested in contagion as a larger theme, you know, than simply writing about COVID and this particular virus. I have been thinking or have been back to my previous book on Wanted Advances about the way that the long after effect of AIDS, HIV, I think had really changed sexual culture and changed our ways of relating to each other in subliminal ways. You know, I saw that in my own students and the kind of heightened moralism and sex negativity that they had that I think was a product of their sex ed. But I just thought about the lingering effects of a virus on all of us at some deep emotional level. So there was that. But I had really had the idea that contagion, or this idea that other people are harmful to us, other people's bodies, other people's sexuality, and the way it seeps out in ways that can't always be contained, you know, that has been kind of the tenor of the culture, and particularly in the context of heterosexual relations, for some time. So yes, the ways that we feel endangered by other people emotionally, you know, also the ways that trauma has become such a cultural trope, you know, which seemed sort of analogous to HIV. You know, it's this thing that kind of lodges deep in your being and that never goes away and you never really recover. Once HIV, you know, became like receded, once there were antiviral drugs and that kind of thing for it, you know, it still seemed like we had this contagion in the form of other people's potential traumatic effects on us. So, you know, contagion became this kind of metaphor for a lot of interpersonal risk.
Yeah, I recall early in the pandemic days receiving a delivery of groceries or something and having this sense that I was just afraid of my fellow human being. And I found that I consider myself a fairly sociable guy. And I found that a really distressing realization that other humans seem like a real threat to one's life in ways that struck me as somewhat unprecedented. But now you're bringing precedents forward that make me realize that my reaction was probably excessively novel. Slavoj Žižek mentioned this anxiety over secondhand smoke as being a kind of embodiment of our fear of the other.
Well, you're breathing something that I guess has sort of been in somebody else's mouth or lungs. And I was interested in the figures who at that time kind of moved between worlds. Like I have a section about sanitation workers and, you know, the ways that they were, I mean, both literally at risk because they were collecting trash that was oftentimes contaminated. And at the beginning, nobody was telling them what to do or how to protect themselves. So they were at risk, but they were also seen as a risk because, you know, they were moving between households and circulating in ways that made them feel like potential plague carriers.
You write about the rise in the share of people living alone, maybe because we've just become more intolerable to be around, and bring forward the suggestion that it's an epidemic of narcissism, and then query your own suggestion. What do you think is responsible for this increased difficulty of living together? And what about this diagnosis of narcissism?
Yeah, I had one time wanted to write a book that was a defense of narcissism, but I got kind of stuck on it. So again, that was another theme that had been on my mind for a while. And, you know, I'm not a sociologist. I'm like an essayist. And so I don't have all the sociological data. Yes, certainly there are these stats about people living alone having increased. You know, I was surmising that people do find other people increasingly intolerable, and to go back to this earlier word, injurious, in ways that I think are somewhat recent. Because, I mean, one, I think there's a kind of development of personality style. I think, you know, particularly if you go down the generations, the younger people are, the more somehow, what's the word, flamboyant people are in presenting their personalities and needs and idiosyncrasies and individuality. So, I mean, personalities have gotten bigger, it seems to me, in a way. I mean, you go into a restaurant and everyone's shrieking, and, you know, you go onto the subway now and everybody's playing their phone very loud. There's just a kind of more demand, I notice, in public spaces and maybe also in private ones, for people to assert their unique individuality. I don't know. Do you find that?
I was going to say, we're about the same age, more or less, and maybe just be that we're getting old and the young people have always been loud.
Maybe so. But yeah, I just do think the demands that get made on people are different. Part of what I was talking about as far as narcissism was the way it's this diagnosis that everyone levels at everyone else. You know, everyone else is a narcissist. The last person you dated was a narcissist, or your ex-husband or spouse was a narcissist. So it's this kind of constant diagnosis that's made of everyone else but yourself.
I almost read a dissertation on narcissism in American poetry many years ago. So I feel a narcissistic wound that has become such a popular term. People have taken it away from me.
Oh, what a great topic that is.
Yeah, Emerson, Whitman, and Stevens were going to be my people.
going that far back, I kind of would have, I thought you would have meant, or they would have meant, like the confessional poets, the later Lowell and those people, you know, Lowell, who was often accused of being obviously a narcissist for writing about his wife.
You know, I was really going to go way back, you know, the creation of a new country and Emerson's idea of self-creation and imperial self.
Well, it is a strand of American culture. And I mean, I suppose I'm not as much of a lit person, you know, as I am, I suppose, somebody reads a lot of criticism, but, well, I read kind of all over the place. But I mean, something about the American voice, you know, going back to Wayne or Melville or, you know, and then up through Bellow, you know, who we were talking about. I mean, there is something about that individual voice has always interested me. And maybe that goes back to the humor question. I mean, those people are often really, really funny writers, subtly, like in the case of Melville, or very overtly in other cases. But that American voice is something that's interested me as a writer.
I'm speaking with Laura Kipnis, author of Love and Time of Contagion, just out from Pantheon. Returning to the ambivalence topic, do we look for a little hate along with the love? Are they inseparable?
I would think they're inseparable. And this is, you know, the psychoanalytic view. And I talk about, I kind of revive this weird early psychoanalytic figure named Wilhelm Steckel, who wrote, he claimed to have invented the rubric of ambivalence, and then thought he'd been stolen, the credit for it had been stolen from him by other people, because he had been, Steckel kind of ousted from the inner Freudian circles. He wrote a lot about ambivalence and wrote this great marriage manual in 1930, I think, called Marriage at the Crossroads, that I quote a lot. And yeah, he would say, yes, that love and hate are inseparable. And I suppose, you know, one could say that it's the hate that kind of infuses the love with some excitement too. So that if you have love that's not ambivalent, maybe it's kind of tedious, boring sort of love.
More Hallmark card sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Did the lockup change your mind fundamentally about humans living together, or just confirm your prejudices?
Yes.
Do you want to expand on that or just leave it at that?
You know, there were ways in which, of course, it was incredibly consoling to be with another person while, particularly in the early days, you know, it was very scary. You felt like the healthcare system was collapsing. The whole national infrastructure was collapsing. You know, there was a madman running the country and things seemed very, very precarious, you know, in New York, where I was in, you know, you were, you know, there were morgues in Central Park, these makeshift morgues. And, you know, those were scary times. So yes, it was consoling to be with somebody, you felt less alone. And there were the household routines that were comforting, you know, meal preparation, etc., trying to find flour and toilet paper. But, you know, it was also a real opportunity for neurosis and projection and acting out on the other person. I'm not talking about my household, of course. I'm talking about other households and what I heard. But, you know, there was, I think, just a lot of free-floating neurosis because everybody was anxious. And I heard some kind of really wonderful stuff about the ways that the whole COVID sanitation protocols became these ways that you had of kind of acting out things on the other person. Like there's something that a story I heard from somebody about their partner insisting on washing the lettuce was so.
Yeah, that really stuck out. Like that sounds revolting, really.
Yeah, no matter how much you rinsed the lettuce, it's still going to taste like soap. And I thought, you know, did this person want to wash my friend's mouth out with soap? You know, because, and, you know, I have to say, for some reason, I actually had to take some lines out of that section. I was in such a rant about it. There was something that affronted me so much about it, even though I wasn't the one having to eat the soapy lettuce. Something about the ways that people just like kind of rode off into this town with these sanitation protocols was really astounding. I would love to know more about all this household neurosis.
You're saying that you had to cut your own rant. Early on, you discussed I guess we're also, you know, libidinally repressed or socially frustrated, that we had a lot of pent-up libido or something that came out in the form of endless moral outrage, where the people were either too reckless or too crazy about COVID, or it's like, and then, as you say, the outrage outraged you. We just have been through a couple of years of intense moral outrage conducted over Twitter very often.
Is that a question?
That's like, no, it's just a remarkable way of venting people's frustrations is just by condemning other people.
Yeah, frustration and aggression and ressentiment and, I mean, all sorts of stuff. It's, no, these are not wonderful times at that level. It's hard to know what to say about it. So I'm not sure what more to say other than that. It's a good topic to write about. And again, it was sort of some of the subject of my last book of Unwanted Advances, and that I continue to write about in this chapter on Me Too. And, you know, I write about my ambivalences about Me Too, which in the early days I thought was exciting and this political grassroots uprising and you know, this retraction of consent and the Gramscian sense from existing relations in power between men and women, you know, mostly men and women, and then became these kind of moral crusades, oftentimes against people for, you know, what resulted in what people are now calling cancel culture, I guess. So, you know, so some part of it was and still is an incredibly valuable thing that we've been through and was in many ways revolutionary, and in other ways has been a kind of punitive and an opportunity for shaming and you know, all sorts of stuff. So speaking of ambivalence, you know, I have a lot of ambivalence about that.
You write about Harvey Weinstein and how he and some of the other early targets of the Me Too culture were hideous, powerful men, and bringing them low was pleasurable to many people. Now, is this justice or schadenfreude, or are the two of those things inseparable, like love and hate?
Justice for sure. I'm to some extent, the pleasure in bringing down an ogre. But, you know, I was also interested in the things that are kind of difficult to talk about, like, you know, you have a figure like Weinstein and many of the others, particularly at the beginning, who seemed so driven by some kind of compulsion, both to prove something or to, you know, who knows what, to rectify some kind of sense of inadequacy of their own. And I talk about the way that, you know, I had an experience a while ago of having coffee with this man who had Tourette's, and he had this tic which involved touching, and he kept leaning across the table and touching me on the shoulder, which sort of migrated to the breast area. And I didn't want to say anything. I was uncomfortable because I didn't know if he could control it or not. And it was one of the things I was thinking about with all of these figures, where you start seeing how serial an enterprise it was for so many of these guys. I mean, it wasn't a one-off, you know, it was like they were doing this constantly and compulsively and habitually and racking up the victims. And of course, it's horrible things happen to the people on the receiving end, but they were acting almost in this robotic way. And it becomes an interesting question, like, can you hold a robot morally accountable for something that's a kind of tick, you know, on the order of Tourette? So if you look at it, if you try to bring more complexity to it, it kind of messes up a lot of the ideas about accountability and moral agency. You know, like, is somebody with a tick a moral agent or not? So it would be interesting if we could have some of those conversations as opposed to just the takedown mode that we've mostly been in.
At the end of the Me Too chapter, you cite women who say they're longing to be touched again, which, you know, makes us think about what the post-pandemic world might look like if there's going to be such a thing. Will the Me Too consciousness reemerge, or what's it going to look like? This human relations have been under such strain for the last couple of years. Can you prognosticate on how we're going to emerge from this and what the lingering sequelae will be?
I think it's probably going to continue in the way that it has been, in which there's just a lot of conflictedness. And this is part of the chapter, which is called Heterosexuality and Its Discontents, or that's the subtitle, where you have, particularly, you know, on the part of straight young women, on the one hand, a kind of attraction to masculinity, even old style masculine power. And I write about these episodes that tend to break out in Twitter where some accusation, you know, there's some kind of round of accusations against somebody who's found to be, and we see this currently with, I don't know, is it West Elm guy or something like that?
Caleb, yes.
Thank you. Found to be serial harassers or abusers in the case that I was writing about. But, you know, women who also are kind of weirdly drawn to abusive men. So there are these undercurrents that are complicated. And, you know, again, it's this kind of weird question about agency. Who is held responsible when you have situations where women actually consent to abusive situations? And that was one of the complications of the Weinstein case, which, you know, was that women went on and had these consensual relationships with him that sometimes, in some cases, went on for years, even after having accused him or later accusing him of rape. So, you know, we have terms like Stockholm syndrome and, or, you know, we used to talk about masochism or female masochism, which is kind of out of favor. But these are very complicated situations that in some ways I think are pretty endemic to heterosexuality. I mean, one of the questions I ask, and I think this is kind of a radical question, I mean, can you have heterosexuality with gender equity, or can you have heterosexuality without heteronormativity? And I don't know the answer to that, but I think it is all kind of in interesting states of flux at the moment.
That was Laura Kipnis, author of Love in the Time of Contagion, just out from Pantheon. Among her earlier books are Against Love, How to Become a Scandal, and Unwanted Advances. That's it from me, Doug Henwood. Let's go with this, some of Slater Kinney's breakup song, One More Hour, as covered by the Tucson-founded, LA-based Fox Bodies. Till next week, bye.